group of the far momentum. Okay. And so from that, we could specify how Lorentz transformations acted on our states. So those consisted of rotations and boosts labeled by the lambda part, and then translations by A. So let me just give the transformation rule for the single particle state. This was just some SA dot 1. And so there was a little group matrix that showed up always in this fashion. Where this W was the involved our standard boost. Okay. And this was our little group element that always referred to some reference vector K through our little boost, through our standard boost. Okay. Right, so we had states, we had Lorentz transformations acting on those states. And we can construct scattering amplitudes from quantum mechanics. All right. And scattering amplitudes from a state alpha to beta, we can just use good old-fashioned perturbation theory. So let me unpackage this notation here in just a second. Okay. This is just some So this operator here we call the S operator. Its matrix elements are the S matrix elements, which give us scattering amplitudes for the states that we constructed. Okay. And we had a time ordering operator here. Let's see. So this construction assumes that we have some free particle Hamiltonian, which is always quite trivial to construct for these states. But then what we do is we turn on some interaction. And this interaction is what's showing up right here. Okay. Now what we'll be concerned with in this lecture is trying to make the scattering amplitudes Lorentz invariant, okay? And that is that different Lorentz observers will construct the same scattering amplitudes when talking about the same in and out states. So what do we mean by that? What we mean is that if I have some scattering amplitude, this should agree with the scattering amplitude that a boosted observer sees when describing the in and out states in some boosted frame, which I'll denote by prime. So what does this mean? This means that if I construct my matrix elements here, remember that Lorentz boosted observers would describe the same state corresponding to alpha would be the U operator applied to alpha. Okay, so this should just agree At this level, we shouldn't, because what we'll see is that when we turn off the interaction, these should just recover delta functions between the alpha and the beta state. Okay. So by construction, when I turn off the interaction, this just needs to recover my usual delta function. You could ask about a phase in, well, let me come back to this question, and I'll show you where I would worry about the phase. Okay. Now, as written, so let me put a question mark here. Okay. When we say that a theory that has scattering is Lorentz invariant, this is really what we mean. Okay. So we should just take this as just a definition of what we mean by Lorentz invariance. So Lorentz invariance is basically equivalent to the statement. Now I can unpackage this. I can either write this as U dagger S, U is the same thing as S, acting on this space of states, but you see this is just equivalent to these U operators commuting with the S operator. Okay. So this is what we mean. Okay, this requirement will constrain the form of the interactions that we can introduce. Okay? Not all interactions will introduce scattering amplitudes that are Lorentz invariant, right? Not surprisingly. Okay, so let's unpackage what this means at the level of matrix elements here. Okay. Just I want to write this expression, which is just some operator statement here. I want to write this at the level of matrix elements. So let's, okay. I'm going to have to introduce some notation here in the process. So let's go ahead and refer back to the states. Let's consider a matrix element. So some scattering amplitude for a multi-particle state with labels 1 through m to a multi-particle state with labels 1 through n. I want to just abbreviate this as pi sigma I pj sigma j. Okay. Sometimes you'll see me use this notation. Occasionally, if it suits me, I may lapse back into a notation where everything in here I just call beta. Okay. If the notation's not important, I may use that as a shorthand. Okay. The statement of Lorentz invariance, I just took a particular in and out state here. This is what I mean by my matrix element. Oh, I'll also sometimes refer to this as S of pi prime sigma I prime j sigma j. Sometimes I'll just use that. All right, I'm just defining notation here so that there's no confusion later on. Okay. All right, very good. So that's on the left-hand side here. That's just our matrix element. I'm giving it a name. So on the right-hand side, though, I should transform all my states using the transformation rules that we derived last time. Right? So let's do that. So if I let me start with the right-hand side. So U lambda A acting on this state here will give me a... This won't be totally obvious, but okay, now we know there's going to have to be D matrices hitting all of these. So there's D matrices on the in states times conjugated little group matrices hitting the out states. And then, of course, there's a translation here. Okay. Okay, so just unpacking this, this is just the statement that these matrix elements have to be related to matrix elements for the boosted states up to these little group transformations and translation phases, okay? Again, this is just a definition of what we mean by the scattering amplitudes are Lorentz invariant.
Question?
Yeah?
Is this true for all Lorentz transformation or it's for a specific set of Lorentz transformations?
This is for any lambda and A. So any boost rotation that we choose, or any translation that we choose, scattering amplitudes would need to obey those properties for us to call it, for us to the theory of Lorentz invariant. Okay. All right. Well, there's a couple of immediate consequences of this statement. So first, let's just specialize to the case where we're not considering boosts or rotations at all. We're just considering translations. Okay. But otherwise, the translations are arbitrary. This is a four vector. Right, that would tell us, just unpacking that statement, that would tell us here is totally unchanged on the left and right. Okay. So just looking at translations, we see that there needs to be an equivalence between S matrix elements evaluated for some choice of in and out momenta by a phase. Okay. This tells us that really what we should assume here is that the S matrix has an overall four momentum conserving delta function in it. Okay, so far that's not terribly surprising. Should go like some delta four. Okay, in this notation here, this is a sum. So I can spell it out here. It should be clear what I mean.
A question?
Yeah.
And the line above, mm-hmm. the exponential, you have minus IA dot lambda. What does this lambda
mean? This is the lambda transformation. This is the, sorry. I said it to one. Yeah, sorry. By the way, no boost just means this is the identity. Let me not write zero. That's going to be confusing to you. Okay. All right. So let's explore the consequences of this translation invariance just a little bit further. All right. So recall from our expression for the S matrix. Right, this will act like the identity, minus I. Right, now at first order, I don't have to worry about the time ordering operator at all. It's only in second order that I have to worry about the time ordering operator. But let's just unpackage this object here. So essentially, I want to just study in the Born approximation the consequences of Lorentz invariance. I mean, recall that any matrix element here, you see, this will start, right, with just some inner product piece minus the matrix elements of the first order term. So this is some, this is the delta function that we defined last time, just the free state delta function. Okay. And inside of here, there of course there should be something proportional to this delta 4. Okay? You need to see this delta 4 in here. Now this is the free particle Hamiltonian. Okay? These in and out states just diagonalize that. Okay, so let's just take this first term. All right, let me just take the first term and unpack this a little bit. This will have a dt e to the minus I e alpha minus e beta. Now, I'm using my alpha beta notation. Alternatively, if this were a state, right, if I had labeled them with the p's, this would be a sum over the energy of all the in states and a sum over the energy of all the out particles, okay? Okay. Now, this piece here, this will give me a delta function for the energy terms, so that'll give me one of the delta functions here. But for the three momentum pieces, this needs to be, right, this should be proportional to a sum over all of the three momentum terms. Let me put a little vector on here to indicate that. Okay. All right, so these matrix elements need to have an overall three momentum conserving delta function in them in order to satisfy translation invariance. Okay. So that means that this interaction term, whatever it is, can be given some general expansion. Of the form, here, I'm going to sum over m and n here. Let me just write this. I'm only going to write this once. So in principle, any operator acting on this space of objects, of states, can be expanded in this form. So I'm giving it, this is what's known as a normal ordered form. But it could just be expanded as some sum over products of the annihilation and creation operators, okay, with a coefficient, right? This coefficient carries the three momentum label. When I'm writing it here, these are all three momentum labels. Carries the little group label, so the annihilation and creation operators are soaking that up. Implicit in this is some sum over those labels here, okay? And then we have a three momentum conserving piece. This is so we'll get translation invariance at the end of the day. Right, here's the function with the three momentum conserving piece taken out. And so this is just the most general form that we can write consistent with translation invariance. Now, one comment is in order here. I want to point this out now, because this statement actually doesn't have anything to do with Lorentz invariance. Normally, and this is true. I mean, so this is true in non-relativistic theories. This is true in relativistic theories. There's a statement of cluster decomposition. You'll sometimes hear it called that. So let me just make that statement now, because that will constrain the form of this coefficient here. So far, I've written something consistent with translation invariance, but now I want to make one more comment about what this can be. So cluster decomposition is the statement that if I have some scattering amplitude involving two sets of particles, alpha 1 and alpha 2, going into two other sets of particles, beta 1 and beta 2, that this, as we pull the particles alpha 1 and beta 1, pulled apart from alpha 2, beta 2, that the scattering amplitude should just factorize. Okay. So if I'm scattering particles in a laboratory right here in this room, and then somebody is scattering particles over at CERN, the results of experiments in this room should really not depend on the results of experiments over at CERN. This is an assumption, okay? We're building this into, we want to build this property into the theory because as far as we can tell in experiments that we do, the results over here are uncorrelated with the results over at CERN.
A question?
Yeah.
If for example, all of your states were entangled with some states in CERN, that wouldn't be the case anymore.
Well, if we prepare the states and they're entangled and then we can protect them from the environment, then we should be able to see correlations. But that's violating a crucial assumption. I put this in quotations here, pulled apart from. So really that should mean they don't interact, but they've also decohered. Because if they haven't decohered, then this isn't going to be true and you'd expect it to not be true. Okay. But what this means is that if I'm trying to make predictions in my lab, I could trace over all the other degrees of freedom in the universe. Okay, and that would just give me the identity, just give me one. So imagine I could trace over all particle scatterings that could happen in all the other labs around the world. That would be like tracing over all the degrees of freedom in this piece of the amplitude. I would just get one, and then I could just focus on calculating that in my local laboratory. Okay, now the point here is that this property places a constraint on these coefficient functions. And again, this has nothing to do with Lorentz invariance. This is true in non-relativistic quantum mechanics as well. And essentially what it tells us is that if we want cluster decomposition to be satisfied, so this property tells us that these coefficient functions with the three momentum conserving piece pulled out should be smooth. Okay, so the V tilde here should be smooth. That's not to say that we can't build theories where this property is violated by putting additional delta function factors or additional singularities in here. We could do that if we wanted to, but we'd get a theory that doesn't quite seem to match with what we see and that wouldn't describe phenomena that appear in our laboratories, that appear uncorrelated with other reactions far, far away. Okay? So we're just going to make this assumption that this is smooth. Now, smooth does not mean no singularities. There can, in principle, be poles here. There could be branch cuts even. But there should be, but things like having additional delta function factors, those will pose a problem for cluster decomposition. Okay. Great.
So, what do you mean by delta function? What are the arguments of these delta functions?
Well, suppose we tried to put an additional delta function factors into the V tilde that involve the Qs. If there were, then we would run into a problem with cluster decomposition. So this is actually a theorem. You can take a look at Weinberg's first volume on QFT if you want to see a proof. There's proofs given elsewhere. I'm not going to prove it, though. OK. So let's continue unpackaging the consequences of translation invariance here. So I'm going to use that expression up there, but I'm going to start to adopt a shorthand notation. I don't want to write that every single time I advance a step. Okay. So that means, let's compute. OK, so I want to pick up where we left off right here. Okay. So recall, the matrix elements for S involved some identity piece, right? And then we had let me just go ahead and specialize to the action J, and this is EI prime. Okay. So this piece, we know, has an overall delta function factor in it. OK, so let's just continue working out this piece. I'm just going to call this star. Okay. This is the only one I want to keep manipulating. Okay. So this will give us some dtx. They'll be our phase factor. I'm not going to write all these sums here. And then we'll have a delta function term. Well, let's go. Just go ahead and insert the expression for V int up there, right? There'll be some dqi primes product over dqjs, right? There'll be a delta 3 I prime minus j. Okay, and then we have the V tilde terms. And then we have matrix elements. Okay, these are the A dagger and A terms. Okay. So note we could go ahead and write this delta function factor as some integral over a coordinate space. We can just write give it a Fourier representation. Right. Now it's actually useful to do this. Because it'll take us a critical step closer to making these matrix elements look manifestly Lorentz invariant. Because now, you know, before I just had some time integral appearing, right? That's singling out the time direction. That's going to be a problem if we're going to make things look Lorentz invariant. So I can apply my U operators to this object, and it's going to fuss around with the time coordinate by trying to keep this object looking the same. Okay, but now at least I can write, you know, I have some I'm not going to worry about my factors of 2 pi. When I write equal sign, I may be multiplying and dividing by 2 pi, but not worry about that. But now this is particularly useful because now I can write this as some integral over 4 space. All right, and this by itself, Lorentz transformations acting on coordinates would leave this measure invariant. So that's actually kind of nice. And then the phase I pick up, minus I, now I'm going to, these are 4 vectors now, x dot, okay, so x here I'm imagining has a time coordinate and then a vector coordinate. X dot pi prime minus pj. Okay, and again, these are 4 vectors. So I can take the energy terms and combine them with these momentum, free momentum terms, and just write this as a phase that involves the Lorentz invariant dot product between coordinate space and momentum. Okay, so that's nice. That object is Lorentz invariant. And then, oops. I need to put I didn't allow myself enough room. Sorry, I'm going to move this over to the right just a little bit. Because I need to put in my, and now we've got this v tilde function. I'm not going to write all the arguments. And then we've got the matrix element involving a dagger and a terms. OK. Good.
Question?
Yeah.
Do you use like the normal order vn?
Yeah, I'm using a normal ordered vn expression. I'm just using this general expansion that I gave up there.
Why are you ignoring this term that has the propagator?
Say again?
I mean, like the difference between the normal, the time order product and the normal order product.
Well, right now we don't have to worry about any sort of time ordering because there's only one operator appearing with one time argument. At second order, I'd have to worry about the time ordering that appeared in the S matrix. Yeah.
When you write the products of DQs, should they be DP or is it? Because you have P's and you have Q's.
Okay. There's P's here. Okay? There's PI's here. So here, just, okay, you're right. That's a little confusing. So, but there's Q's in here. Okay? I probably dropped my sum, right? So did you catch that I dropped my sum over M and N? Right, this is a general expansion for an interaction term or an operator. Right, so I should have a sum over M and N right here. I should have a sum over M and N right here. Right, so this object, this right here is a sum over M's. Okay, so I could say this is, you know, I equals 1 to N, this is J equals 1 to M. I suppose this would get confusing if we use the same N and M on these in and out states. But in principle, these two guys have one set of labels, and then the labels appearing in your operator expansion are different and totally independent. Okay, and I'm summing over all sets of groupings, so there could be some 3 particle term, a 4 particle term, so on and so forth. Okay. But now we're almost ready then to go ahead and take a critical leap here. So note that what we've got here is something of the form. It's some integral over 4 space of something that at least naively appears local in this position space. And at least part of it looks like a Lorentz scalar. Okay. In principle, we've got this big mess to deal with. We're not quite sure what this does under Lorentz transformations. But starting from this form, note that if when I apply Lorentz transformations through this, these U operators, when I apply it to these to this interaction term, if the only thing that this does is transform like a scalar, okay, plus terms, I'm not quite sure what these could be. But at least if it transforms like a scalar, this whole thing will be manifestly Lorentz invariant. Okay? We can apply our U dagger operators to change frames, and this object will not change. Okay? Because I'm integrating over four space here, so I can just do a simple change of variables and I get back the same object. Now, these other terms, what could they be? Well, they could be boundary terms, or they could be terms that integrate to zero. But the simplest thing to assume is that there are no terms that we pick up under Lorentz transforming this interaction Hamiltonian. So let me go ahead and keep a little subscript here. Interaction. Now, I'm just saying that if this is true, the S matrix will at least will appear manifestly Lorentz invariant, at least at first order. We're not quite done. Remember, there's a second order term, and I said there you'd have to worry about the time ordering operator. So we'll get to that in a second. So we see a huge class of theories is one where the interaction Hamiltonian is just some four integral over a local interaction term that's a Lorentz scalar under Lorentz transformations. But that's not quite enough to make the S matrix Lorentz invariant. It will be manifestly Lorentz invariant at first order. But remember, right, we have a time ordering operator in our expression, right? So the time ordering operator doesn't affect this first term. Said that V int was integral over four space. Let's but now I'll get some piece. Sorry, there's a minus sign here. Whatever. There'll be some time ordering operator on an integral d4x1 d4x2. Right? We don't want to forget about that. Now the problem here, okay, so suppose x1 minus x2 is time-like. Okay, in that case, the time ordering is totally invariant under Lorentz transformations. If you have time-like separated vectors, you're not going to change you're not going to change the sign of x10 minus x20. Okay? So this is fine. So basically the T does not change anything under boosts. Right, you see if I, in the region where x1 and x2 are time-like separated, I could perform a Lorentz transformation that would transform all the coordinates. This would look Lorentz invariant, and because the time ordering is not changed in that case, this time ordering operator would do nothing to the state, so I would just get back the same thing. Okay, but if x1 minus x2 is space-like, that's not true anymore, right? The temporal ordering of events is not invariant in that case. Implied, the time ordering operator changes the S matrix terms by commutators. Okay. Why is that? It's because the time ordering operator chooses an ordering for the operator corresponding to the temporal ordering of x1 and x2. If x1 and x2 are space-like separated and I perform a boost, I can reverse that ordering. So I get back the same object up to commutator terms. Okay? And not just these commutator terms. It's these commutator terms integrated over space. But you see from this that if you want the S matrix at second order, and actually this continues to all higher orders, if the commutator of the interaction Hamiltonian vanishes for space-like separation, this will imply that the S matrix will be Lorentz invariant to all orders here. Fast second order, okay? So we see that we can get a completely manifestly Lorentz invariant S matrix if this object that we constructed, and this was by construction, we just used translation invariance to build some h of x here. But if this is a scalar and it commutes at space-like separation, we're done. Our scattering amplitudes that we constructed in the Hamiltonian formalism will also give us a set of scattering amplitudes that are completely Lorentz invariant. Okay. So how do we ensure that all of this, we still have this structure left over, will actually give us something that will satisfy these properties? Okay. Well, let's do the simplest case of a spin zero particle. So I can now drop all my sigma labels, okay, because there's no additional labels for spin zero. I'm going to group things suggestively. Okay. Okay, I'm using our expression for h int that we had before. Let me go ahead and pair up these phase terms. Note that there are, hold on one second. This may not be completely obvious, and I'm happy to come back to this point. It's not clear. It'll take me a little bit too long to clear it up. When we were working through these terms, I was actually computing matrix elements, and I want to drop this computation of matrix elements and just talk about the operator b in. Okay? But what I'd like to do is keep in mind what our in and out states were. Okay, so I want you to have in mind that I had a particular in and a particular out state. And the point here is that the only non-zero matrix elements you're going to get for a given choice of in and out state are going to involve terms in the interaction that have enough A's and A daggers to soak up the A's and A daggers that are used to build the in and out state. Okay? So it's not going to be some arbitrary collection of A daggers and A's. You're going to have exactly an appropriate number of A daggers to pair up with the out state, and exactly an appropriate number of A's to pair up with the in state. Okay? So this statement can be formalized, and we can use a modified version of what's known as Wick's theorem, which you may have seen, which allows you to just compute these. You actually have all the information you need to exactly compute these matrix elements. But that's going to be implicit now when I write hint. Okay, so I've got a particular in and out state in mind. So you might want to make a note of that in your notes. Okay? So now when I write this down, I am going to specialize to the same set of indices that I use to label my in and out states. So this was, I think, 1 through, somebody remind me, was it N or M? It was N. Okay. Right, so now I have a dagger of QIs at product of these. And I had a product J's. Okay. And it's only the combination that has the same number of A daggers and the same number of A's as the corresponding in and out state that will give me a non-zero matrix element. So I'm only going to write those right now. But then what I want to do is I have this phase term here, e to the minus I x dot summation over all these PIs. I can pair up the phase terms with the A daggers and A. There's one phase term for each A and A dagger. Okay, so this whole thing. Okay. Don't forget this term. Okay. There's a D tilde there. Okay, so now I want to pair these phase terms up. Now I need to be a little bit careful here. Again, I think I'm going to have to come back to this because otherwise I have a feeling you're not going to understand why I'm replacing P's with Q's here. Oops. I should actually replace my P's. Yeah, let's come back to this. Okay, so this is QI prime, A dagger of QI prime. Okay. That's a product over all of the outstate terms, and then a product over all the instate terms. So we're doing this for spin zero. That implies we can drop all sigma I terms, sigma I labels.
You change the P for the Q because then you will pick a delta function when you...
Exactly. Yeah. So let me just say it in words. And then if it's not totally clear, I will remind you of this point either in the next lecture or tutorial. It's a small point. It's a quick calculation. But when you're computing these matrix elements for a given in and out state, you're only going to get non-zero answers. Well, when you get non-zero out answers, you're going to pick up delta functions that force the Q's and the A and A daggers to be the same P's that you had in the in and out state. Okay, so that's why when I write this expression, I change the labels in the phase to the same labels as the integrals here. Okay, I don't want to go through all this algebra in real time, so I encourage you to do this as an exercise. Okay. All right. So now what do we have? Well, in this particular case, D tilde. I always keep dropping this D tilde. Now, this object almost totally manifests in the Lorentz invariant. Almost, right? This is an object, right, that's going to have a nice simple Lorentz transformation property. When I act by UU dagger on an A dagger state, that just changes the label from Q to lambda Q. But I can change the label up here, provided I change the label on x to lambda x, right? So you see this is an object that under Lorentz transformations transforms like a scalar, okay? Same with this. This is Lorentz invariant. As I've written, though, these weren't quite Lorentz invariant, right? These were integrations over just three momenta. So that tells me what I should do if I want something that's going to be at the Lorentz scale or a manifest Lorentz invariant. These little factors that I was carrying around just needed to be little energy factors for the in and out states. So there's a product. Okay. And I could have chosen this earlier. The reason it should be these factors is that D3Q over EQ, where EQ, I mean, this is clear. If we're given three momentum, I can take the energy of the state as EQ. This is a Lorentz invariant measure. Okay. You may have seen this in your field theory courses, but this is what shows up anytime you want to write something as a Lorentz invariant integral over phase space. Okay. I could have just done this from the very beginning when I expanded things out, but I was not trying to. I was trying to show you that you could just more or less guess the form of these V tildes even had you not done that. Okay? So if we do that, so I'm going to just make a side note here of that. Then this object just becomes a product of phi. Ooh, what's the convention? Oh, darn. I made a sign error. Oh, it's later. Okay. This is a plus, not a dagger. Plus. This whole interaction Hamiltonian just becomes a space integral of a product of these scalar quantities, okay? Where the phi plus and phi minus x should now be fairly familiar characters from your field theory course. So for example, right, this phi minus x is just d through q over, I'll reinstate the pi's. Okay, I was using the mostly negative metric convention, so I must have screwed up my sign somewhere. But I think in that convention, normally we say this is I x dot q, value it, where q naught is evaluated at eq here. That's three vectors for you. Okay. So these should be familiar looking objects from field theory. Okay, so now this is pretty clearly manifestly Lorentz invariant, at least looking at first order, right? Because we've just built the Hamiltonian now as a product of Lorentz scalars, integrated over coordinate space, so this whole object will be Lorentz invariant. But what about this condition? That we needed at second order and all higher orders to get something that's Lorentz invariant. Is this true?
So you made the sign error just after cluster decomposition. You made the sign error just after the cluster decomposition.
Now you caught it? Great. I screwed it up over here then. So
it's on the middle board.
All right. Let me not spend time on it, but make a note of it so that we can fix it in the notes later. Okay, the problem here is that for some totally general product of these scalar fields. Now I'm going to call them fields. For some general product, this condition isn't going to be true. Okay. Just in general, the problem here is that the phi plus terms and the phi minus terms their commutator. Okay, now why do I say commutator? I mean, at this point, I haven't said anything about statistics for these particles, right? I've not said the words boson. I've not said the words fermion. So actually, we have no idea if these annihilation and creation operators are commuting or anti-commuting. So let me go ahead and reinstate that freedom here. If you compute the commutator or the anti-commutator, where you compute a commutator if you assume the statistics is bosons, and you compute an anti-commutator if the statistics is a fermiform. In either way, in those cases, let's give this a name. This function here, this is a Lorentz invariant function which does not vanish for space-like separation. Okay? Because of that, when you compute the commutator of the Hamiltonian at space-like separation, if you had to assume Bose statistics in this calculation, you would have picked up commutator terms of these pieces, which don't vanish at space-like separation, so you would utterly fail to satisfy this condition. Had you assumed Fermi statistics, you would have got the same result. You would have picked up commutators of these pieces, but because the anti-commutator is this object, you would have picked up these plus operator terms. You'd still get something that doesn't vanish. Okay? So either way, there's sort of an obstruction here. Okay? So the way to fix this is to try and build this interaction Hamiltonian, instead of out of phi pluses and phi minus, we'll build it as out of a linear combination of the two. Okay. So A and B are arbitrary, they're just their coefficients. It's this or it's conjugate, right? Because now if I'm taking linear combinations of the two, when I conjugate it, I'm not going to get back the same thing. So try to build H out of phi of x and its conjugate. This is now a dagger. Okay? With A and B chosen so that phi of x phi dagger of y is 0 for space-like separation. And phi of x phi of y. Okay? So you would try to do this, because if this is true, then you have a chance of satisfying this, we sometimes call it a causality condition on the interaction Hamiltonian. Okay? So let's just go ahead and compute commutators and anti-commutators. Again, I'm not yet assuming any connection between spin and statistics here, okay? I want to remember this sign though, because this is a tough sign to stay. Okay. I'm going to skip all the algebra here. Okay, so now if we actually just compute commutators or anti-commutators, so phi with itself 1. This calculation is not too laborious, so I encourage you to go through it once. Okay. So here's what you see. So suppose you had assigned Fermi statistics to these annihilation and creation operators. So you're trying to use a scalar field. This is confusing terminology, right? Because you're so used to the usual spin statistics connection. I'm asking you to assume for a second the wrong connection. See what would happen. You're using this scalar field, but suppose you had paired up Fermi annihilation and creation operators with it, so they anti-commute, right? So that's the plus sign. Then for all choices of these coefficients, you'd have a non-zero anti-commutator at space-like separation. And I told you that would pose a problem for satisfying the causality condition. So you'd be in trouble, okay? So if you tried that pairing, you wouldn't be able to construct a Lorentz invariant S matrix. If you try the other pairing, so that the annihilation and creation operators commute, they have both statistics, then you see this can work, right? Because now this is the now the minus sign, because now you get a commutator that is zero. Okay, so both statistics. And setting the magnitude of the coefficients the same. Right, now this does imply that, say, phi of x, phi of y, dagger is 0. So x minus y squared less than 2. Okay. And similarly for the phi of x with phi of y, okay, etc. So now once you've got that, you're good to go. Now your interaction Hamiltonian, built out of these fields, paired the right way with statistics, the correct assumption of statistics, we'll give you an S matrix that's Lorentz invariant, okay? So what we have here is that a Lorentz invariant S matrix implies that we build the interaction Hamiltonian out of phi of x and phi of x conjugate, where phi of x now is the field that you're used to working with from your field theory courses, right? So phi of x, we can now just take this to be phi of x plus phi of x minus, right? And that's the familiar looking combination. And here's the important point. With the assumption of both statistics, okay? Now we can repeat this construction for more than just these scalar fields. We could have done this for other types of fields that carry other types of Lorentz structures. From the bottom-up point of view, that would have been required any time that the in and out states actually transformed non-trivially into the Lidl group. All right? You would not be able to build the interaction Hamiltonian out of a product of scalar fields. They would have to have some Lorentz transformation properties. Okay? And you remember, the representations of the Lorentz groups, we went through this. I mean, you can have objects that transform like scalars. You can also have spinner objects, right? Okay, and here's the point. If we were to repeat this construction for particles that anti-commute have Fermi statistics, the only way you'd be able to actually build an interaction Hamiltonian that satisfies this property is to use wave functions or fields that transform like spinners, okay, that have some spinner index. Yeah.
And for this scalar field, if we assume the Fermi statistic, does it violate only the causality? It's just
the causality problem. I mean, because the first order term wouldn't have given you a problem necessarily, right? Not directly.
I mean, is this the only problem? I mean, like, does it, if I assume Fermi statistics, does it give a bounded from below Hamiltonian?
Oh, you're asking, is this the only contradiction? No, I think we can construct other problems. But I don't have a complete answer for you off the top of my head. At the level of this construction, this is the only problem we run into, because I'm only considering I'm only talking about on-shell observables, so in-states, asymptotic past time, out-states, asymptotic future time. Okay. So this is where the connection between statistics and spin comes from, or this is one way of seeing where the connection between statistics and spin comes from. And this is also a way of seeing why it is that we go about building our interactions as products of fields, okay, that carry particular Lorentz transformation properties. I'm going to stop here. There's a few remarks I'll make about the generalization of this to other cases. I only showed you the spin zero example, but I want to give you a flavor for why this works in general. So maybe I'll take 5 or 10 minutes next time to do this. But as far as we can tell, this procedure used to build scattering amplitudes that are manifestly Lorentz invariant is sufficiently general that, in fact, there aren't many examples that we know of. There are some, but there aren't many examples that we know of where the scattering amplitudes cannot be written in this way, in terms of an interaction Hamiltonian that's written as a product of fields. Okay. So this is why whenever we sit down as physicists to build a theory that describes interacting particles in quantum mechanics, if we want Lorentz invariance, it suffices to build a field theory. Sometimes there'll be more than one field theory that packages the same physics, but it suffices to build a field theory. Okay. All right, so I'll stop there.